From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Worldviews. Today, I'll talk with Joshua Landis about Israel's disappointment with remarks Secretary of State John Kerry made regarding Middle East peace talks.
Both sides wound up in positions where things happened that were unhelpful.
It's too painful to try to come up with a different basis for peace talks.
And Rebecca Cruz explains why the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide has rekindled tension between that country and France.
So there was a little bit of surprise that he came back out now when relations are improving.
And later, I'll discuss international law and targeted killings with former State Department lawyer Harold Koh.
Drones could, in theory, be a much more accurate and humane and lawful way to conduct conflict.
The news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott. Joshua Landis, Rebecca Cruz. A couple of interesting stories this week. Joshua, let's go to you first. Israel and Palestine still working on these talks. Of course, the United States definitely involved in the middle of that. The Israeli foreign minister visited Secretary Kerry. We've had a rough go of it this week, largely in response to Kerry's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Both sides, whether advertently or inadvertently, wound up in positions where things happened that were unhelpful. And so day went by, day two went by, day three went by, and then in the afternoon when they were about to maybe get there, 700 settlement units were announced in Jerusalem, and poof, that was sort of the moment.
The Israelis not happy about this. What on earth can we expect now?
Well, this is really about what is America trying to do to get peace. And our policy since the 1967 war in which Israel occupied the West Bank has been a two-state solution. The occupied territory will go to the Palestinians for peace, land for peace. But those parameters have changed, and they really changed 3 years ago under President Obama when he tried to kickstart these talks again. And Prime Minister Netanyahu said, we're not going to go back to the 1967 borders. And we're not going to stop building settlements because this is Israeli land. Obama caved, and partly because Congress wanted him to cave, and Americans are very supportive of Israel. And he realized there was no upside for him to pressure Israel. And he left it to his Secretary of State, who tried to reanimate this, but without being clear about whether you're going to be 67 borders or whether there's something else that's going to happen. And Netanyahu has stuck to his guns. The Israelis have stuck to their guns. They're continuing to build settlements at a pretty fast pace and take Palestinian land, or what land that the Palestinians claim is their land. So they're not going to negotiate, and this fell apart over this same issue. And it's unclear what America – you know, America keeps on telling them, well, we can't want peace more than you want it. And it's too painful to try to come up with a different basis for peace talks. Obviously, that's going to have to happen at some point. But American foreign policy is still two-state solution, even though it looks like that is not going to happen.
Well, I think the Israelis aren't often used to the United States being quite upfront regarding their settlements and the issue and that getting in the way of the peace talks. So they've now prohibited high-level talks.
But it looks bad for Kerry, so, because it's not only Israel. It's Syria and it's Ukraine. And people like McCain and others are taking them to the woodshed and saying this is a trifecta of loss. You're losing on every one of these things. And so it hurts Obama going into this new election cycle.
Well, Rebecca, off to another part of the world. This week we marked the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. And this is an interesting story, too. President Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, came out and said that France bore some responsibility for that genocide, suggesting that because the Rwandan military at that time that was participating in the slaughter of Tutsis had been trained and supported by France, that France continued to support the Hutu government as the killing began, that French peacekeepers appeared to take sides and allowed perpetrators to flee through French-controlled areas, and that, in fact, a lot of these people have went to France and are living with impunity. So, you know, guilty of participation? I mean, is this really, where we are on this? France is guilty of genocide?
Well, this is an ongoing issue. Kagame, of course, was part of the Tutsi rebel group that eventually took over and has been leading the country ever since. And he's made these claims several times. And in fact, in both countries, commissions have been put together at various times to investigate this. The committee in France in the 1990s determined that there was no wrongdoing by the French, that they perhaps made some mistakes, but they were not culpable for any wrongdoing in the actual genocide. And then a recent or more recent commission in Rwanda that came out and said that they were not only responsible for the genocide or for allowing it to happen, but that some French soldiers actually took part in it. This has led to discussions between the two countries essentially being stalled until 2009. So there was a little bit of surprise that he came back out now when relations are improving, when there was a trial recently in Paris to go after one of these Rwandans that's been indicted on charges of genocide. So there looked to be a little bit of progress. And then this comes right on the heels of the commemoration of the 20th anniversary.
But commemorations often give us an opportunity, right, to go back and think about these things and perhaps reopen wounds, or in this case, maybe even expose wounds that haven't fully been healed. I mean, it's been, you know, only 20 years, and there's still a lot of – there hasn't been the reconciliation and time for that reconciliation and forgiveness and healing.
There hasn't been a lot of time for reconciliation. The French are obviously angry about this. But if we think about it, 20 years, it's maybe a generation. You have children that were alive during this time. You have the results of war rape, something that was very prevalent during the Rwandan genocide. So the children of these women that were raped are now coming of age as well. So those animosities continue. We'll continue to have some issues within the country and certainly issues between Rwanda and France going forward.
Rebecca Cruz, thank you for that. And Joshua Landis, as always, thank you very much to the both of you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion and answer any questions you have for the three of us. Leave a comment in the Worldview section of our website, or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Grelot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. Next, I'm joined by Yale Law Professor Harold Coe. He served as the top legal advisor to the U.S. State Department from 2009 until 2013, and strongly voiced his support for the legality of U.S. drone strikes during a widely publicized speech in 2010. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Harold Coe, served two U.S. presidents as an attorney with the U.S. Department of State. He worked as the Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor during the final years of the Clinton administration, and President Obama nominated him to become the State Department's top lawyer in March 2009. In 2010, he delivered a widely publicized speech arguing for the legality of targeted drone strikes. You can watch those remarks on our website. Between those two assignments, he led Yale's law school as its dean between 2004 and 2009. He left the Obama administration at the start of the president's second term and returned to Yale early last year. Harold Coe, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
So you've had such a distinguished career in international law, and I really just kind of wanted to start with a general discussion about what that is, what international law is. Many people struggle with this concept. They consider international law to be a violation of state sovereignty, that international law is weak and that it can't be enforced, that it's really a reflection of the interests of powerful states, that it's really, you know, doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's not worthwhile. What would you say to somebody who's a skeptic about international law?
What it does is it sets up patterns of conduct that we follow and that people expect to be followed. So it gives a kind of certainty to life. To just give an example, when I was a student, if you went to Europe, you couldn't be sure that if you lost your luggage, you'd get paid. When you got to the other side, you had to have traveler's checks. If you had a visa for one country, it didn't get you into another country. There are no communications mechanisms that allowed you to let your family know where you were. International law has freed us in remarkable ways to do remarkable things. We now have luggage protection under the Warsaw Convention. Electronic funds transfers allow you to draw money from ATM machines, the Schengen visas. that allow you to travel all across Europe. So it's an enormously liberating thing. And, you know, now I think what people are concerned about is we're part of these networks, so people who are also part of these networks have influence over us. My answer to that is, so we're part of a legal network. We're also part of an economic network. We're part of a cultural network. We're interdependent with the rest of the world. We have influence over them. They have influence over us. So why should we build this structure and make it stronger? Because it's the thing that gives us the most capacity to control the future in a common destiny. And I think the most important thing is that the United States is a country that, when it was a small nation, tried to win the respect of the world by talking about its faithfulness to international law. The Declaration of Independence says, out of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, we understood at that time that if we didn't follow the rules on piracy or war, we would be isolated. So we followed international law. That's what small countries do. And I think if we want to continue to be a global leader, we have to play by the global rules. I mean, if you think about it this way, if you ask how should we talk to China, you say, if you want to be a global leader, be a part of the global system and play by the global rules. And that's all that we're being asked to do reciprocally.
Well, it's very interesting to hear you talk about the very practical aspect. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize these kind of day-to-day things like luggage and financial transfers are practical aspects of international law. But you've gone further, and of course, in your many books and articles and the work that you've done, to talk about transnational jurisprudence and international law as a critical for order in the international system, and that concepts like, you know, that we hold dear in this country, liberty, equality, privacy, are not just American ideas, but are part of a global human rights movement. So it's not just about practicality and engagement, you know, in kind of day-to-day business and travel and communications and the way in which we live our lives, but that there's something deeper to it than that. And you were kind of alluding to it when you were saying, you know, as far as global leadership and being, you know, setting the standard as kind of global leader, that international law is a requirement for that. But it's deeper than that, isn't it? I mean, you've written, it seems to me, that there's something more that would indicate, you know, in order for us to spread liberty, equality, privacy, those kinds of ideas, international law is a requirement.
So just to give an example, nearly 60 years ago in Brown versus the Board of Education, our Supreme Court said that segregated schools are not equal. Separate but equal is inherently unequal. So if another country, say South Africa, were addressing the same question under their constitution, and the question is this equal protection or equal treatment, you would expect them to look at what another country addressing the same set of issues did 50 years earlier. Why do you want to be ignorant of a relevant precedent just because it's not from your own system? You're not bound to follow it, but it's good to know. So a lot of this is simply the statement that various issues have been addressed by different systems. For example, I learned to my surprise that gays and lesbians were admitted to the military publicly of Germany in 1969. So they have 43 years of experience with it before we finally address that question. One of the things that people were saying as a matter of fact was that having gays and lesbians in the military would disrupt the cohesiveness of military units. It turned out that American soldiers have been serving alongside German troops and NATO forces who are gay. So nobody said that those units aren't cohesive. So it's a way to test factual claims that are made to see whether they're based on any fact. Or let me give you another example. Our Constitution forbids cruel and unusual punishments. But up until quite recently, a number of states of the Union allowed the execution of people whose IQs were less than 80 and who therefore have mental retardation. And there's a lot of research done on this. We learned that there were only two countries in the world out of 193 that permitted the execution of people with mental retardation, the United States and Kyrgyzstan. And so a brief was filed at the Supreme Court that said, this is an unusual situation, at which point Kyrgyzstan filed a brief in which they said, we've stopped doing this. It's only the United States. And within the United States, it turned out that only about 20 states had this law in the books, and only about 5 had actually used the law ever. So our Constitution says no cruel and unusual punishment. If we're the only country in the world that does it out of 193, and in fact, if only about 5 states of our 50 states do it, that's unusual. And it seems to me that that's what our Constitution anticipated, that if something becomes unusual, you question whether it's constitutional.
And international law is obviously helpful for that in terms of putting it in context in a global environment.
Well, I see international law as quite simply about the advance of civilization at various levels. When states are in a state of nature, they deal with each other through force and threats. As they start to cooperate, they create communal relationships. Sometimes those relationships are set forth in norms and rules or agreements, just like a neighborhood agreement in a condominium complex. So if people have resort to these rules and dispute resolution mechanisms, it avoids them fighting. And it's a way in which you essentially have a kind of law that governs the community. That seems to me is putting your ingenuity on behalf of creating structures to avoid conflict. If after all these years we haven't been able to develop such mechanisms, then we haven't advanced much. Now, just because we have them doesn't mean that they're straitjackets or that they can make us do things that are counterproductive or dangerous. But certainly it's worth the effort to try to have such rules.
I'm speaking with Yale Law School professor and former State Department legal advisor Harold Coe about some of the practical aspects of international law. We'll talk about his 2010 speech on the legality of U.S. drone strikes right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest today is a professor at the Law School of Yale University and the former top lawyer at the U.S. Department of State. When we left off, he called international law a resolution mechanism to create structures that help avoid conflict. I have to ask about the a specific case that you've commented upon. In 2010, in fact, you gave a speech where you strongly supported the legality of drone strikes. I mean, as we're talking about advancement of civilization and an avoidance of conflict, you came out suggesting that drone strikes for targeted killings in places like Pakistan and Yemen and others where it's a part of that global war on terror is legal and just, I suppose. And so how do you square that around with what you were just saying regarding advancement of civilization and avoidance of conflict? How do you separate those two things? Help us understand that.
Yeah, so there are three key points. Number one, not all wars are between nation states. What happened on September 11th was the start of a armed conflict between the United States and a non-state actor, Al-Qaeda, and it's a transnational organization. So that requires some translation of the laws of war to this new situation. Number two, the history of warfare is using more and more remote weapons more and more precisely. So at the beginning, there's face-to-face combat. Then you had bows and arrows and then spears and then catapults and then bombs and now we have drones, which strike with tremendous accuracy. My point was that these are not per se illegal. They could be used lawfully. So I think if you use one to kill Osama bin Laden, that would be lawful. If you use it to kill a child, that's unlawful. So what determines whether it's lawful or not is what rules you apply and follow. The third question, after all, many people defend the use of the nuclear weapons, which are by their nature extremely indiscriminate and always kill civilians because they just can't be controlled in that way. Drones could, in theory, be a much more accurate and humane and lawful way to conduct conflict. The final question goes to Al-Qaeda. It seems to me that we're not at war with most of the people of the Middle East. Arab Spring gives us a chance to reach out to their hearts and minds and try to persuade them to join us in some different kind of exercise. But there's going to be a group of people, and Osama bin Laden is one of them, who don't want to be Democrats. He didn't want to be the leader of a country. His job was designing bombs and weapons to kill innocent civilians. And the response against him was in the context of the laws of war. And I think that if drones end up achieving that outcome, I don't like that, but I don't think it's illegal. As a lawyer, I would say that's a lawful use of drones.
So to relate that and connect that then, as you were just making this point about using these types of technology to protect innocent civilians, to protect others, those to target and get rid of those who are dangerous to other people, if I'm hearing you correctly. Can we connect that at all to this larger issue of the responsibility to protect and to engage in humanitarian intervention? And if so, why is this so difficult for us to deal with this issue, you know, in terms of engaging, whether it's in Syria or, you know, in Darfur or wherever it is? Why is this so difficult for us, this concept of responsibility to protect, if it's lawful, as you're saying? I mean, because it's lawful, I guess, doesn't mean that we will do it.
Yes. Well, it used to be we were just limited by our physical capacities. There was a time when even if we'd wanted to do something across the other side of the world, we couldn't do it, or we couldn't get our military assets over to where they needed to be. Now, since you have the capacity, the question is when do you have a responsibility? Now, I'm struck, for example, in Syria, many people talk about a pro-peace position as not intervening. Not intervening means a war continues and that innocents get slaughtered. So to do nothing is to let war continue. Now, then the question is, can you satisfy the principle of first do no harm? Is it possible, together with other countries, to use military action to prevent slaughter from occurring? I think this was brought to a head when there was a clear and undeniable attack on children with chemical weapons. Now, some people say, well, look, the UN Charter says you cannot violate territorial sovereignty because of a if there's no Security Council resolution because the Russians have vetoed it. If that were an absolute rule, then every country that had veto could commit genocide in its own territory and there'd be nothing you could do about it. The UN system values more than just territorial sovereignty. It values human rights. It values peace and security. So I think we need to look at this issue going forward. It's obviously in a state of flux, but I think just asserting an absolute rule doesn't make any sense. Finally, there are people who say it's legitimate, but it's illegal to do humanitarian intervention. I would say that when the ERA failed, did we say it's illegal but legitimate to want to have equal rights for women? You keep pushing that until you get to a better legal rule.
Well, certainly very interesting and a lot for us to think about. Harold Koh, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Harold Koh, a professor at Yale's Law School, who served both Presidents Clinton and Obama as a lawyer with the U.S. Department of State. You can find video of the 2010 speech we discussed about targeted killings on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Nick Aguilera serves as our research and digital content intern this semester, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grolot.